One, two, three. Hello. Welcome to Read the Fifth. Here's our standard intro that we're going to try to memorize over the course of our next couple books.
I'm gonna try and do this all Twilight Zone.
My sister thinks she's Rod Sterling.
I wish.
Please forgive.
I wish.
The delusions of grandeur.
Hello, and welcome to Read the Fifth, where we try to be good judges of character, especially our own. My name is Melissa Matos.
My name is Jonathan Matos.
I am the writer of Strong Warrior Women, Femme Fatales, and Feywild Women.
Feywild Women, yes. And I'm the author of Cain and Abel and other sad and suspenseful stories based on the tragic heroes of scripture.
I realized I said women twice in there when I shouldn't have.
Oh.
That's my own fault.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was wondering how that, I was like, I hope I didn't do that.
Trying to sound all cool and it came all terrible.
But
you should read my stuff, momtoast.com.
Oh, yeah. That's Enjoy. Where you can find her things.
And you can find him. He's actually all published and stuff.
Yes. I took the plunge into self-publishing. But this is kind of
a really good audiobook. Find him on audio.
Yeah.
Are you on Audible?
Yeah. So how it works. So forgive the neophyte here.
I don't know.
Basically, there's a page for Cain and Abel, and you can find it on audiobook, print, and Kindle, all on the same page. But that's not the topic of this episode.
No.
This
is Read the Fifth.
Yeah. Basically, the idea is that every fifth of the month, we're going to get the same book, and then sometime before the end of the month, maybe towards the beginning of the month, the next month, we'll talk about it in our podcast.
I was going to say, it's already like the ninth, isn't it?
What was that?
It's already the ninth,
yes.
Isn't it?
But we're going to try to target different – this is a little peek behind the production side of things, is that there's usually some kind of reason why the book is relevant that we try to pick out, because Melissa had a really good production note where I was picking out things from like the 50s and 60s because I feel like that's when literature died. And the, like, for example, we did an episode on, the Defender of the Faith, the short story.
It was a really good short story.
And it was really good, but like, who cares on YouTube? And
have we done a Hemingway
podcast
episode yet? Oh, we did.
We did Snows of Kilimanjaro. So like, I want as much as possible to, be like in the conversation on like BookTube and have it be something that like, you know, like, for example, there's a Catch-22 show coming out, so we might talk about that.
Which scares me, actually.
But Melissa is scared by a lot of things, as we'll go over in the thing. But that's another thing, is that Melissa and I don't really see ourselves as critics or as, you know, authorities on literature. More so, this is, for those of you who haven't listened to our podcast, it's just an excuse to talk about the nerdy things that we would normally talk about. And because I've started reading a lot more literary fiction, this is kind of like our banter might get, you know, we're siblings. So like, there are things that are going to get like, you know, it's a little bit more personal for us than just two people that happen to be collaborating on YouTube. So hopefully we're going to try to keep it civil, not like we're going to bash each other.
When have we not been civil?
At the same, no.
We're always civil. Don't let them talk about it.
Yeah, it's not that we're not, that's what I'm worried about, but it's more like I would want to pick something so that we could have an interesting conversation.
Yes.
As opposed to just picking something because she likes it, or her picking something because I like it.
To be fair, though, we have very interesting conversations even about.
Right, yeah, and that's
not very heavy stuff.
That's been an interesting thing about reading this book, is that it has sparked a lot of conversation that we might not have normally had. So the way that I'll talk about this is, what were your expectations going into this book? Just hearing that it was the basic thing being, this is about a Native American person in the 30s, and there's a crime.
Well, I didn't even know the part about there being a crime.
Uh-huh.
I just thought it was going to be, because I had read other things like There's, what did I read in high school? I had to read two different ones. There was Black Like Me, and there was another one from about the same time.
Okay.
So I thought it was going to be just more experiential discussion of what it was to be Black at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I didn't know there was a big crime involved. I didn't know it had such a anti-hero character.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know any of that stuff. So going into it and immediately getting smacked in the face with what Bigger's character was like was very surprising.
Yeah,
it was some harsh stuff, man.
So yeah, surprising. And yeah, I would say the same thing, that I kind of assumed, because it was being, and this is going to, I think, affect my discussion of this, that there's a lot of things like, okay, I hear that this is being adapted into a film. I'm assuming it's going to be the same tone as the things that I've seen, like, become popular because, like, oh, this is about racism, or this is about the criminal justice system or something. So, like you're saying, what was surprising about it when you start to read it is how transgressive the character is. Like, we were talking the...
Especially considering that it's from, like, because I don't tend to think of the... 30s, because it's the 30s, right? Mm-hmm. I don't tend to think of the 30s as having literature that's like that transgressive. Like, I usually don't think of that stuff starting till like the 60s and 70s.
Right.
So it surprised me a lot that also that it wasn't as, what's the word I'm looking for? Because the way they treated movies at the time,
mm-hmm.
you know, they had to keep everything really squeaky clean.
Right.
And there was a lot of not really censorship, but like, control over what you were
allowed. Well, there was a lot of censorship. But
like, control over what was allowed to be on the screen.
You don't
expect... opposed to this novel, which is like, okay, well then.
Yeah, you don't expect it to get that deep at that time, because, number one, you associate the civil rights movement with a Black writer being able to have a voice about the authentic experience of being Black. You don't expect that to be something that would have been popular or very
prevalent at the time.
Yeah, widespread during the 30s. And I think it was published in the 50s.
Okay.
But it's about the experience 30s. of the 30s. So we have a character of Bigger Thomas, who is growing up in like a slum, and he lives with his mother, his brother and sister.
In one room, or not one room, but one bedroom place.
Right. And we have their character set up, and there's this kind of image of he kills a rat, and right away he's like torturing his sister with the dead rat. This gets more significance later on, but as far as being introduced to the character.
Right. So it's like he kills the rat, he tortures his siblings, and then has instant communication problems with all of them. Like, it's not just like, you know, typical morning argument. Like, there is obviously stuff up in this relationship with his family.
Right. And that was an interesting point to me, because I know, like, for example, if you read Hemingway, there's a lot of ways that he portrays the emotional, like, stuntedness of men. And it's just interesting because during this time in the 20s, it was really the first time. It was when you were starting to get this internality of the writing voice. Like, it's not just about these plot elements and just getting the third person perspective. You're starting to get a lot of that internal stuff. And it's interesting to see how it sets. So you have his relationship with his family, and then you also get that he has this gang that he rolls with.
Right.
And it's Gus and I forget what the other guy's name is. Gus and Jack, I think.
I don't know.
I
only remember Gus because he beats the crap out of Gus.
Yeah. So that's...
Like, they're supposed to be going to knock over, like, a liquor store or something.
I think it's a deli.
Or a deli. I don't know. But it's the first time that they were planning to rob a white person.
Mm.
So Bigger's freaking out And his response, instead of telling them, hey guys, maybe we shouldn't do this, mm-hmm. he beats one of them up.
Mm-hmm. So I think this is a good part to talk about the difference between the film and the book. Because I think what going into the film, and it's an A24 production, for those of you who...
We lasted maybe 5 minutes, 10 minutes. That was about it.
But I need to tell the good people that it's the makers of Hereditary and Ghost Story. I forget some of the other, but they're very big in the horror space right now because they're making very avant-garde horror movies right now. They might have also be doing that Lucy in the Sky movie that Natalie Portman is going to come out with. Remember?
Yeah, I remember the thing. I'm just bummed if that's actually them making it, because.
But like that is a good, like, since you, I don't know if you've seen any of the footage from those other movies, but that style is very prevalent. But it's interesting to me that even though this studio is being lauded for its artsiness, it still very much sanitizes a lot of this character development that you get in the book.
Yeah, because within the first 5 minutes of the movie, he was already a very much more likable character than he had ever been in the book.
Right.
He feeds a stray cat, and he's like getting presents for his girlfriend and all this stuff. And you're like, right. Oh, see, he's just trying to make it, like, no.
Bigger in the book is nothing like
you're
that.
Just like, I hate this guy. This guy's an idiot. What is he doing?
Uh-huh. Right. And that's, I think that what I was going to try to make a point about was that I think literature is going to a place where you get a very traditional, you could say, like, maybe like Dickinsonian type of story where, like, even though it's about like the slums or about poverty and stuff like that, you still get very noble characters, and it's a very easy pill to swallow, right?
Most of them.
I guess maybe for the time.
Oliver Twist was rough. But most of them were, there's like at least one somebody that you can latch onto and say, I like this guy. This person's trying to be a good guy.
Right. So, my criticism would be that when you start getting those stories that they're not trying to create, like, I think the benefit of a transgressive story is that you have a character who necessitates the conflict. Like, they're completely opposed to something about society. And so the benefit that you get is right off the bat, you see, oh, this character isn't, like, Bigger Thomas from the narrative, you see, oh, he's going to be asked to work for this rich white guy. Something's going to go wrong.
Right.
And so as opposed to this, where, like, nothing's really drawing you into the movie because the movie is just this – but like you were saying, like, if this is good, like his
and then I was like, and they're trying to show them as, like, I don't even understand what social group they were supposed to be. Granted, I am not, like, in touch with the gangster side of Philly anymore, because not that I really ever was. we used to live in a worse neighborhood, so, like, we saw stuff. I've never seen anybody dressed like this. Mm-hmm. At all. Maybe I don't hang out at the right hipster places.
Right, so there's the style aspect that isn't really justified in the narrative. He has, like, a leather jacket that he looks very much like an 80s punk person.
Yeah.
That has white, like looks like metal bands written all over
and
it.
And I don't know if they were trying to make it look like he's a kid that's trying to look like a thug.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they were like, this is their version of a thug.
Right.
It's like, if this is their version of a thug, I felt like I could beat the thugs up. Like, they were not that.
You were joking that, like, his friend was vaping.
Yeah. I'm like, what is that?
So, like, there's all these different things where, and some of the artsy stuff.
Whereas, obviously, in the book, the minute you meet his gang, you're like, no, these are kids that knock over store. Like, they're not.
Yeah.
Like, they were criminals, hoodlums. They were just straight up.
So I think the balance that I have tried to work out for myself mentally as I review, as we talk about more literary stuff, is that not all these characters necessarily have to be as militantly nihilistic as Beta was, right?
But not
that doesn't necessarily make a good story. At the same time, the contrast between the film and the book, you get this is this character, this is how this character might be in these circumstances, and you. Reading the book, I was always on the edge of my seat with this character because I don't know what he's going to do.
I
don't know what somebody's going to do to him.
Because then it's like he said, the minute you realize this is who this character is, and then he's going where to get a job?
Right, yeah.
It's just going to explode. You're not quite sure how, but something horrible is going to keep happening.
During the introduction, when you're meeting the family and the gang, they're setting up that there's this... there's this job that a relief program is providing him and that he doesn't like, he could be, you know, couldn't be less interested in taking. And until he goes to this movie theater and he sees this white woman on a beach and she's with her boyfriend and this gossip kind of like newsreel anchor is saying, you know, beautiful white teenager kid, like, ferried off into the Florida sunset by communist ne'er-do-well. And so...
That was such a weird part. Well, because I listened to the audiobook. I wasn't reading it. And so the guy did the radio announcer voice.
Yeah, very really much well. Like a 30s.
So I was just like, this is creepy. This is like voyeurism. Like, why are we watching this poor chick on the beach with her boyfriend? Like, although this is me talking. There are loads of people that watch the Kardashians.
And, yeah.
And... you know,
so, but it was interesting. It was interesting because you don't think of the 30s
as that
vacuous in nature.
Well, I knew it was vacuous. I didn't know it was that. I don't know how to explain it. Cause watching, cause I like a lot of classic movies, classic movies, you know, it's very, there's the, you know, tinsel town, Hollywood, everything is this built up ideal, beautiful thing. But like, I don't think of people being like reading the
tabloids
about them, but there were, because like, I mean, if you watch Singing in the Rain, that was a large part of that whole thing, is that there was this whole back end stuff about them. I just, for some reason, it doesn't really
it is interesting to hear it, and then Bigger realizes oh wait, that's the daughter of the guy that they're offering me a job to work for, and so he starts like thinking differently, and it's not, the text isn't like clear about whether he's like, I'm going to, you know, proposition this girl or something, or if it's just the idea of like
of being near her.
Yeah. You That's know, it's not, thing. It's not that cut and dry.
I will say Richard Wright writes it very, very well, but there is a whole lot of,
I don't know which one you're talking about because the there's two. One. Okay. Yeah. That they need context.
Okay.
There's an assault. And anyway, that's further in the plot. But for those of you who are planning to read this, there are depictions of these things. And because it's limited to Bigger's perspective, it's not an omniscient narrator saying, and he was a dirty dog for having done this. It's all Bigger's perspective,
so it's
showing all the things, all the reasons why in his mind he feels that these actions are necessary. So within the plot, we get that he wants to start working for these people. And right away you get this feeling of like, you know, like, because there's like a gate and he's worried about like, if it looks like he's trying to break in, what's going to happen to him.
The amount of second guessing and paranoia that he has was very interesting. Because on multiple levels, as somebody who suffers from social anxiety, that was familiar, like, because I go through that kind of thing all the time. But at the same time, I'm not also expecting someone to shoot me for it. Like, it's one thing if you're going through social anxiety and you think, oh, this person's going to hate me the rest of my life. Okay, fine, whatever. It's a different thing for this guy who literally could get arrested or beat up or shot for doing the things that he's about to do. And he needs to think 60 million ways from Wednesday if this is going to be okay. So it was a weird feeling experiencing that part of the story. Right. Sorry, I keep throwing stuff in there. But
But yeah, no, that's, I mean, that's your perspective on that, that narration. And another thing that I was worried about in terms of filming this or recording it was that, like, listening to you say that, it feels like, well, the story necessitates that. And, like, it kind of speaks to a white person's ignorance.
Yeah.
And, of course, I felt the same way, too, but it was a little bit less in effect for me because I've just finished a manuscript about that. And so putting myself in those shoes, I was trying to picture that, like, what's it like for somebody before the civil rights movement to act a certain way in front of white people. And so it was gratifying to read this and see that all of these things are confirmed by somebody that had to live through them during this time, that, like, he is so constantly aware of this being a potential situation that he can't act naturally, and that he's worried at any given moment what's going to happen to him. So he starts working for Mr. Dalton, and the way that it sets up these characters, I think, is interesting because I think a modern reader, might expect, okay, he's still going to start working for these white people, and they're all going to be overtly racist, right? You're going to get them saying ignorant things all the time, and it's going to be about his conflict with them on a personal level. That couldn't be further from the truth. Mr. Dalton is asking him about, like, things of his past, but then saying, like, but that doesn't have any effect on your job now. And there's this thing about Mrs. Dalton tries to get the people that they hire to try to go to school if they haven't gone to school. There's a maid that works for them, Peggy, who is just kind of like this jovial person, and she's trying to get him settled. And so
trying to identify with him because she's like, I'm Irish and people treated our people like that too, and that kind of thing.
Right. So it's like, as far as their characters are concerned, I was just kind of like, oh, like, he's not just using white people as a straw man.
Right.
Like, he's not creating a version of white people that makes every single one of them somehow problematic in some way.
No.
Like,
but
he's leading into this situation.
I think the goal was definitely more to point out the faults of racism by ignorance rather than overt racism.
Right.
Obviously, the overt racism was there, and there are characters, but they're not main characters in the book that show it. Mm-hmm. Like, it's more later on, like, when the reporters and the cop and all those guys show up. Mm-hmm. They're very much more overtly
right.
racist.
Mm-hmm.
But the family is very much more, well, this is what we're supposed to be trying to do, right? We're trying to help them out. We're trying to make them part of our group. And then I think mostly shown by the daughter and her boyfriend when they show up.
Yeah.
Because his first job is to take the daughter, supposedly, to a lecture down at school.
Mm-hmm.
And the daughter, of course, being the rebellious young lady that she is actually going to go on a date with her commie boyfriend, which immediately puts Bigger already in a bad situation because
now
he's going to have to lie about where they've been. She gives him liquor, and then the two of them start acting as though it's all just fine, that they can be his best friend.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, you have no idea what you're, like, in his mind,
yeah.
You see all of us, this is like, you have no idea what situation you're putting me into. You guys have absolutely no clue what this means.
Right, yeah, and that's that ignorance, that consequence by ignorance. It's not that Jan and Mary are consciously trying to oppress Bigger.
No.
There's just this idea of, as these bright-eyed, bushy-tailed young people who have this...
It's that post-adolescent idealistic phase.
Yeah. They have this idea of that because he is a... and it's not like we're reading into it. Like, he says he's a communist.
But he's a communist. He is.
He's part of the communist party. And that was interesting for me because as a comic book reader, I was used to having people like Stanley and stuff.
People that grew up in the 80s and 90s, you don't, you know, overtly come out and say, hey, I'm a communist. How are you doing? It's not what you do.
Right. Well, in certain circles. And that's, I think, my point is that this is getting across. These are young people who very much believe in the communist cause. They're not necessarily like terrorists that are trying to blow up the Capitol or something. But at the same time, from my childhood, there were a lot of lessons about McCarthyism and saying like, they thought all these nerdy guys that would never do anything to anybody were communists. And, you know, like you hear about like Malcolm X being on the FBI watch list and stuff, just because you're intellectual and you hold like public gatherings.
Right.
That you got put that J. Edgar Hoover thought you were a commie. But no, he's actually a communist. And because they believe in the communist cause, they're thinking, well, it's very simple. You just sit down with a black person and take them to a restaurant predominantly patronized by blacks. And in the 30s, there's not going to be a problem. And Bigger immediately internalizes this as very patronizing. And he feels like, you don't know me. Don't act like you know me just because you have all these highfalutin ideals. And like Melissa alluded to, you get this thing where because Mary gets drunk and Bigger's responsible for her, he has to return her to her bed. He assaults her because he's attracted to her and his moral and character isn't going to prevent him from
touching her up.
He starts feeling her up, but then...
To be fair, neither does she, really, but still not exactly okay that she
he's just
passed out and he's doing whatever he feels like doing.
Mm-hmm. But then, lo and behold, he turns around. Mrs. Dalton, we hadn't mentioned, is blind. She starts walking into the room and he immediately is just possessed by fear. He's like, if she catches me in the room with I'm dead. So he takes a pillow and is trying to quiet Mary to prevent her from waking up. But he holds it for so long and so hard that he suffocates her to death. And so
we're going to explore the consequences of that.
Yeah.
After the mid-roll.
When we left off, we were talking about the start of this kind of the catalyst for the rest of the plot. What at this point, what are you feeling? Because I when it got to a certain point, I started seeing more of how, because it's shocking, the murder and the cover up are both very graphic and very upsetting to listen to, because I also heard the audiobook. But then it got to a certain point that I was starting to see maybe what direction it was going. But right away, I'm like, I wasn't expecting this, and I'm kind of unsettled by it, even though, like you said, the writing quality is not kind of changed. But what were you were saying that this emotionally affected you?
Not this scene, the other scene.
Oh.
Which is surprising. Well, this scene, I was just like, okay, you're an idiot. And I thought that the whole time he kept trying to cover things up. I was just like, oh my word, dude, just leave her there. Say she died of alcohol poisoning. Just leave it. Like, what are you doing?
So you, if you were, like, you putting yourself in his shoes, you would have just, like, skipped town?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or not even left, because, like, so the whole, this, all right. So yes, it was shocking, and I was like, okay, this is crazy, but we've already seen you're a horrible person, so I'm not insanely surprised.
Uh-huh.
So then my brain went into what I usually do if I have to read about an evil character, and I start getting very pragmatic about everything.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, okay, fine. Good job. You burned the body. You burned all the tools. You made it look like she was running away with the boyfriend, which is totally plausible because she's done it before. Like, all that other stuff was fine.
Mm-hmm.
The problem comes in when he starts getting greedy about it. And he decides that he's going to write a ransom note to the parents to get money out of this.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, okay, now you're just being retarded. Like, that is a whole new level of stupid. Like, just leave it. You covered it up. It's done. It's over. They'll eventually figure out she's dead, but they're, like, it would be months later, and they would have no idea it was you. But no, he's got to get all greedy about it and want to rub it into their faces that he did this. Because that becomes the thing. It's not, oh my word, I killed this girl, and it was an accident, and he's not guilty about it. He's not, oh my word, I have to cover this up. It's, I did this, and they have no idea that I was smart enough to do. Like, he almost starts getting offended that they think other people had to help him. They think it couldn't have been a black man because look how smart this was. It's just like, no, this was me. And I pulled one over on these stupid white people. Like, that was like his thing. I'm like,
yeah.
Okay, look, dude. Like, really, it's not the way to go.
Well, okay, so this is interesting. And I think I want to push back on something, but as previously stated, I don't want this to sound vindictive. But it seems like with readings, you tend to be very judgmental of the characters. And with this story, what I'll say to position this correctly is that I often criticize, there's a book called The Stranger by Albert Camus. It's often used to show existentialism to high schoolers.
Why they need to teach this to high schoolers, I don't know, because most of us will have no idea what that means.
99% of the literary fiction that we've talked about that has transgressive characters, you tend to say, though, this person's evil or stupid is usually the terms that you use. And what I would say in comparing this to The Stranger, what I think that this does effectively is it tries to make an argument for existentialism in the sense that it's trying to present the existence of a black person as this non-deterministic thing. So like, if you're going to go full, or not non-determinism, determinism, it's trying to say like, because he's in this situation, there are things that are outside of his control that make him act this way. So rather than arguing for his selfishness necessarily, which to my opinion, why The Stranger is so stupid to me is that this guy has this very meandering writing voice. He talks about all these experiences that he has. One day, the sun gets in his eyes, he shoots somebody. It's a piss poor argument for existentialism because there's nothing, there's no logical, there's no logos in that. There's no truth to that to me. It's not speaking to any deeper.
Well, yeah, like, thing. So I'm not trying to say that I don't think that it's written well and that it isn't proving that point. I do think it is because, like I said, the initial assault, well, not the assault part because that was wrong. Wrong. I mean, all of it's wrong, but I mean, but I don't think he had an excuse. I don't think he had an excuse for the assault part. The murder part, I understand that.
Right. And
he is put in a situation where it doesn't matter what he was doing in that room with her. Even if he hadn't smothered her to death, he'd have been punished for that.
Right.
And that wouldn't have been fair because he was helping her to bed. She was about to pass out in the car. So he was literally just putting her to bed.
And real quick, I want to preface that the book is clear about it being an accident.
Yes.
Like it wasn't
not intentional that he killed her.
Right.
It was intentional that he was assaulting
her. Because after he does it,
story, but
there's a line that says he checked to make sure what he assumed happened.
Yeah.
It wasn't something that's like, okay, I did it. It was like, oh, wait, what did I just
so
do?
So I understand that it did. It made a good way of showing he had to do this. He didn't do it on purpose, but there are reasons why it fell out this way and he had to cover it up. Like that part I got. But like I said, it took his character to the place where his character was going, and it made him even more greedy. And then the second murder was totally not necessary.
No, I agree. But when we get to that, I'll agree with you on that point. Because what I'll say is that one of the things that came to mind in even the assault in the beginning is that it's strange to me in a lot of ways how this book will pay some lip service to relations between men and women, but it doesn't necessarily flesh that out as much as the racial part. So we get these things about like how the he's ashamed of like his mom and sister are changing in the beginning. And there's this big thing about like
not watching them,
you know. Yeah, and so like I think Richard Wright is effectively showing how this guy has a very strange like relationship with women in general.
Right, in general, he is so like I like how you said at the beginning. It's showing him very emotionally stunted.
Right.
Like there are a lot of relationships he does not understand. There are a lot of ways to express emotions that he does not understand.
Right. And
he only has a very limited range of options.
Right. And to his point, like you were saying about being pragmatic about the character, I think that there are things that show that he is highly intelligent in certain ways.
Yeah.
Because he is as intelligent as he wants to be. I guess yes. You could put it like he's very street smart. He doesn't let necessarily people like pull wool over his eyes. There are certain things that emotional stuntedness is kind of separate from those more pragmatic
things. And I mean, and it does a good job of explaining he is the way he is and he knows how to succeed in certain things because that is what society has dictated.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
right.
This is the way black men are supposed to behave. This is the way black men of a certain wealth class, like economic class, are supposed to, like, he knows what the limits are. He knows how to talk to people as long as it stays in that circumstance.
Right.
The problem happens because Jan and Mary try to take him out of that and he has no context for that at all.
Right. And it scares
the crap out of him.
Yeah. So even with that first assault, what was going through my mind, as a man, but also as somebody that's trying to look at the more existential point to it, was that it seemed to me like what he was trying to get across was there's no way for this guy that he could ever date this woman.
Right.
Like, so it's not like there was a path really to sex with this woman in a traditional way. So obviously it's reprehensible what he does. But I think on that existential level, he's showing that like this person,
that's the only way he knows to get this.
Right. And this person taking me out to dinner, treating me like this is like, acting like we can just be friends. And so there's a lot of that toxic masculinity in it.
Also because, as he makes the point later when they ask him why he did what he did to Mary, it has nothing to do with him actually liking her. Like that assault is what assault is always for a guy, and it's he hates her.
Right.
And wanted to show that power over her, and so that's why he did what he did. It has nothing to do with like any, I mean, there is physical attractiveness, obviously, but that is the extent of it. Like, there was no emotional connection there at all.
So that's the thing. So, like, I don't want to make it sound like to you or to anybody watching this who doesn't want to read something that has rape or assault in it. I don't want to make it sound like I'm making the case for that to necessarily be a part of a story. Like, it doesn't improve it. It doesn't detract from it as on the basis of it alone. And if you have that, if you have that visceral reaction to it, there's no reason why you need to put yourself through it. But at the same time, I think that this is well written enough to show, like, it's there for a reason, because this character has his, like, all the circumstances that he's in as this toxic man. He's using that and saying, I'm going to take it out on women. And we'll get into a little bit more of that later. It also mentions, part of that toxic masculinity was that he brings up that, like, seeing Nazis on TV and stuff is almost like, that's the only way that he knows power exists. And so it's almost he kind of thinks about like, well, if the only way that I can have competence is if I show dominance over somebody else. So that's also kind of like it. And so when he goes back to his house, he starts seeing his sister and his mom and his brother as being blind. And I feel like that's part of what it's trying to get across, is that when you strike out at somebody in bitterness and you have the strength to take from somebody what you want, all of a sudden everybody else starts looking
like targets. Saps. Yeah.
And like, you're just going to let people take what's yours. And so it's an interesting thing, because it's, I don't think Richard Wright is trying to make the case like you might expect. If you start reading this and there's communist characters and they're the one reaching out to the black guy, you might think, oh, Richard Wright's trying to get me to think, you know, if all of us rise up and cut the heads off the kings, then that's how we're going to get what we want. But I think more complexly, he's creating the situation where it's showing how all of this, all this situation of being in a slum and having to work for these white people just to get anything, it puts him in this mindset of, oh, if this is this what power is, okay, then I'm gonna try to get mine. He goes back to his house, then tries to attempt a ransom, and that's when we meet Britain. Now, I thought that Jan and Mary were
bad.
Ignorant.
And then this cop shows up.
Yeah. And I think it's appropriate that his name is Britain. I think that it's supposed to be like
a very imperialistic
symbol.
I have not wanted to strangle a character that badly in a long time. Like physically tear him to shreds. It's awful.
Yeah.
And he doesn't even like, and there's no consequences for him. Dalton, who is nothing like that, doesn't say anything about it.
Right.
Nobody. He's the cop, and that's his job, and he knows how to beat the truth out of the poor black boy that he's got. He doesn't even suspect that the guy did it. He's right. just making it look like he suspects the guy so that he can figure out what actually happened.
Right.
And it's awfulness.
And so right off the bat, and that's something that, like, if you were to write a manuscript, as we've been working on, like, I was trying to do this balance of, like, I don't want to just throw the N-word in there or something in there just for shock value, right? So, like, if I'm going to find a literary agent that wants to market this to young adults, there might be some words that, by society standards, need not be in there. But at the same time, this book has the word boy at least 100 times, if not more. And I'll tell you, like, it was like the effect of that over time built up to where, like, I wanted to kill them just because they were calling a boy.
Between him and the reporters that show up, it was just like, can I just burn the house down now? Because I can't stand any of these.
And so I think that's to
Richard Wright's. But in a believable way.
Yeah, to Richard Wright's credit.
Because I have seen other portrayals of open racism like that, that was not this believable. For some reason, this I believed. Like, I was like, he knew somebody like that.
Yeah,
like,
right.
He knows that guy. That's a real guy somewhere
right.
in the 30s that actually messed with him. Because it was just that kind of level of, you've got to be kidding me, right? But no, this is, like, right here in my face. And he's just like, yeah, I expected this to be right here in my face.
And right away, he's trying to pin it on communists. He's, like, trying to look for an excuse to blame it on Jan. And
that's communist, all, Jews, or blacks. That was, like, the only vocabulary he had. I'm like,
yeah. So, so
made me ill.
So yeah. So I think this does a good job of escalating in terms of, like, you know, Bigger has one opinion towards the Daltons and white people in general. But having this
super racist character,
he immediately goes from being fixated on Mary to being fixated on Britain and being like, this guy doesn't think that I can do this.
Because that he understands. He knows that guy. He knows that those guys exist and was expecting that guy to exist, as opposed to the other people before, where he's like, I don't even know what to do with you guys. Like, what are you doing to me?
Right.
This guy, he knows.
Right.
And he knows how to behave around him. He knows how to talk to him. He knows how not to look at him. Like, he's got all this stuff in his head of, this is how this works.
And that's some of that intelligence that I'm talking about in that, like, in watching the film, it just seemed like this is a normal teenager. And he's like, they're not really showing the complexity of how Bigger is in the books. Where,
except they had him listening to Beethoven for some reason.
Yeah. Yeah. There's those little things that's just like, it's just kind of weird. But there's a subtlety in the book of, like, this guy is severely emotionally damaged, but at the same time, this very Machiavellian person who's like, I know. And so this is the portion of the book where he's trying to get everything pinned on Jan. Jan's one of the last people to see him. And because he's a communist, he knows, oh, wait, they hate blacks, but they hate communists even more.
Yeah.
So, like,
hate those guys too.
I'm just going to get it put on him.
Over there. And he almost makes it.
Yeah, he
hadn't gotten greedy, he'd have made it.
Yeah, he makes a poorly written that's a sad note. Thing. But yeah, he writes a ransom note. He tries to get his girlfriend Bessie, who we haven't talked about, but when he goes earlier to the diner, predominantly black diner, he runs into Bessie and doesn't even want to look at her because he's with these two white people. And he's like worried that everybody's gonna, like, laugh at him because these guys are these, you know, two 20-somethings are like
that have no clue.
These two, it's like, yeah, people. We like fried chicken. Like, yeah, they're doing all this stuff that's trying to make, like, it look like they know his world.
People, please stop.
And so he tries to get Bessie and pretty much emotionally abuses her in terms of, like, just like saying like, no, you're going to do this or else I'm going to
manipulate her. Cause he knows that he's helped her steal stuff from people she works for.
Mm-hmm, right.
He totally just blackmails her into it.
Yeah. And this is where we get this, there's this kind of like, so he starts this plan and at the same time, all these reporters are coming in to, find out like any scrap of anything that they can know. So that they're just vultures of characters. They're just like they're trying to get Britain to force the family to come and make statements, and they just won't let anything go to the point where they start realizing that the furnace is like there's something wrong with it. They start investigating and they find one of
Mary's bones.
And immediately he's like, I'm out.
I'm like, I'm done. Bye.
Yeah. He's runs away and, starts trying to hide with Bessie and try to make it so that they can, escape. But this is where it gets to the part where
I can't take it anymore.
Yeah. Where it, myself in this person's shoes, right? Even if I don't like this girl, right, that I'm with, I'm just thinking like, if he's running away, they already know that it's me. Like if I'm bigger and I ran away when they found Mary's bones, then I'm pinned on it.
Yeah.
She's not going to be able to tell them anything that I don't already know. So, but what we get is Bigger has this, I think, very self-hating, thing. And it starts from the beginning of the book. He's when he's insulting Gus, he's calling him black. And like, there's all these things about like, there's the stupid black people, like my family and Gus and Bessie. And then there's me. I'm the strong person that's fighting this system. Right. And so, basically he thinks I can't have her telling anybody anything. So, and this is part of my reading education in this, cause that's, to me, that's a big part of, if you're going to read this, it will educate you on a lot of things. It's not for entertainment value.
No.
It's just to teach you what things were like. So one thing that it taught me was that when I read this, it didn't seem like a rape to me because this is a character who has had sex with him before. But obviously,
that doesn't mean nothing.
Yeah.
Because I was totally wrecked the rest of the day after reading this part.
Right. Because there's a history of emotional abuse here. He makes her feel like the only thing that makes her valuable is if she kowtows to what he wants. And so it doesn't matter that there's, and at this, I'm saying this is a very toxic thing about my perception, was that it educated me that it doesn't matter if this person's in a relationship with you. If they're saying no, they're saying no.
Yeah.
So that's what happens in this scene. She's saying no, he doesn't care. And then when she falls asleep, he beats her to death. And so what, like you were saying, this was like an emotional upheaval.
Yeah.
In your reading.
Because the first murder, you're like, okay, I understand. I don't agree with what he did. Mm-hmm. And I know it was wrong, but I can understand why, because of the way things are right now, that happened and it was an accident and mm-hmm. you need to cover that up or they're going to like lynch you in the street. Like I get that part, okay. Which would not have been right either. Like the, what they would have called justice would not have been justice.
Right.
This though, this was, no, you're just a horrible person. And you did this solely because of your own fear and your own desire to have power over other people. And there is no excuse for this one.
Right.
Like, but the interesting thing, I think, with what Richard Wright does with that, because I don't know, maybe if that's just us reading it now, where the first murder would be kind of considered forgivable and the second one not. But what happens at the time, he goes to trial and they don't give a crap that he killed Bessie.
Mm-hmm.
They care about him killing Mary.
Right.
So you as the reader are looking at this like, no, you don't understand. The real reprehensible thing of him is the second one, not the first one.
Right.
But they're going to crucify him for the first one. And the second one is just sort of secondary proof to the fact that he would have done the first one.
Right. So that's the argument I think starts to be made in it, is that it's trying to conflate the white's objectification of Bessie for his objectification of it. And so I feel like it's not the strong, like, as far as plot elements go, if you were to just tell me this story and I didn't read it or listen to it, I would start thinking, like, this is a bridge too far for the reader. They're going to be like, I can't trust this person anymore. And as far as how times have changed, I would say that, like, we need less of this in fiction. Like, the idea of, like, a woman just being, even if you're trying to make a larger societal point about how men see women, the head in a fridge thing is played at this point. And so that was something where I can agree with you in terms of, like, it's frustrating to read because they're just using this woman's death as a way of making an emotional point about a man.
Right.
And it's not, like, regardless of the how you feel about reading scenes like this, watching them on a visceral level, in terms of the storytelling, it feels very difficult to get through because you know that it's just being used as part of this, as part of Bigger's perspective.
Yeah.
Bessie wasn't really a person.
No. She didn't really have much character to her before that.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't let her have any much character when you finally did get to see her. It was just him browbeating her the whole time.
Right.
And then that happened and you're like, well, yeah. Okay.
So as far as there's positives and negatives to how it's used within the story. But I would say in terms of having to get through it, after that point, I was like, you need to do some shit in order to justify that this happens within the story. And so after this next break, we'll start going into the trial and how it does a little bit of that work.
Hello again.
So the trial, I think you start getting more of the expositional ideas of what...
This is his manifesto.
Yeah, it starts getting that. And I think that the first two sections, you can make the case whether they earn it or not. But I feel like when you finally get down to it, okay, this is what this character is like compared to this other character, you start getting a little bit more context for stuff. So Bigger is finally caught after this kind of like extended sequence of trying to run away. And we get really, like, before this and after this kind of mass hysteria that's starting to brew because
there's like a big manhunt that starts and people are beating up other random black people just because
we're starting to get that this is like an excuse for propaganda because they print this evening edition that's all about like mothers don't want their children to go like protect hide your kids hide your wives like all this stuff of like we need to make sure everybody's safe from this menace. It's an interesting thing because like you were saying, you really hate this character. But at the same time, you see all these ways that like, because they don't really know the truth of the whole situation, you're like, well, he's not a serial rapist.
Right.
And it's not like,
it was like listening to like descriptions of the Loch Ness Monster or something. Like it was that level of ridiculousness. They're just like going off in this big sensational, crazy.
The hyperbole of it.
Yes. It's like, what is this nonsense?
Yeah. So you start getting all that. He finally gets caught. He like climbs this,
the water tower.
Water tower.
They like hose him down to get him to drop the gun.
Right. And I think it also leads to his psychology because he needs to, like, admit he needs to think that they're afraid of him. It says something like he's wondering like why are they being so cautious? And then he realizes, oh, they're scared of me. And that's when he finally like lets go.
Yeah.
Like he's like freezing to death up there. So he's like, okay. It's very like mute after that. Like he's not. It's kind of like
he doesn't struggle. Well, then they knock him senseless.
Right.
Like, drag him, literally. That, as much as I hate the guy, because I do.
Judging him by the content of his character, as Martin Luther King said, he's not the best guy.
The treatment of him once he's caught is just as bad. Yeah. Like, they don't catch him like a regular criminal and just handcuff him and take them away. It's like, no, we're just going to drag them down the steps like a sack of potatoes. Mm-hmm. And we don't care if he survives getting to prison
mm-hmm.
or any of this. Like, I'm just like, he's still a human being. He's a wretched human being, but he's still a human being. Like, can right. we pretend that we're like a justice system mm-hmm. and not.
But to your point, that's where you start getting that as in terms of the subtext starts becoming text, because a pastor visits while he's in jail and starts going on to this whole thing about Genesis
mm-hmm.
and about how and about the being imbued with meaning as a human being. Like, you're denying your meaning as a human being by doing this, but Christ can redeem you.
Right.
And so it's a very beautifully written thing, and I appreciate that. Whether or not Richard Wright believed in communism or whatever beliefs he personally had, I think he did a good job of showing that this pastor really believes what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
And it has this very beautiful way of expressing this Christocentric idea.
Right.
But then it's contrasted with Jan coming in. At first and saying, like, listen, I forgive you, as hard as it is to say, for what you did to Mary, because I realize, in his communist possessed mind, I realize that there's a reason why you did this. And I'm going to offer you Max, who is this attorney. And what we start getting is this symbol of it meaning more to him that this white person is the first person that's like, trying to understand how he feels, as opposed to this redemption through Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in my read through of it, I was starting to see how perhaps Richard Wright's intention was that the killing of Bessie was really the killing of him as a black person. Like, this idea of there's one thing of lashing out at whites for what they've done to him.
Oh yeah, but then killing her was.
But killing her was like killing his soul,
yeah.
kind of thing. And so, as I said, I think we've grown as writers and readers to the point where we don't necessarily want to condone objectifying a woman's death as some symbolic thing. Like, I think there's positive and negative ways to show violence towards women, and it's kind of become a trope to have somebody's emotional thing tied up in something towards a woman that doesn't get to be a whole character because of it. But I started to get this idea of, like, he sees the blackness as other blacks as being weak. And it's like, oh, you're one of those people that thinks that if I just pray to Jesus, then everything's going to magically be okay. I'm going to reject that and accept more of this. And you start seeing that, like, Max is trying to get him to admit some of the reasons why he did what he did, even if it wasn't a good thing to do, that at least maybe in their defense talking right. about
they can show
all those
how the societal pressures, you know, this to him. Personally, though, I still think he drew it out too long.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this whole section could have been, okay, he got arrested. The preacher comes to see him,
mm-hmm.
and then we get that part. Jan comes to see him. I did like both of those.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that I necessarily saw it as a rejection of his blackness. I don't know. I was thinking of it more in the sense of, so the preacher's promising him, yes, this life is terrible,
mm-hmm.
but the next life will be better
mm-hmm.
kind of idea.
Right.
And Baker's like, I don't accept that. That's not, we can't, no. I want this life mm-hmm. to be what it should be.
Sure.
Which, to be fair, there's nothing wrong with fighting for this life to be what it should be. There should be justice in the world. There should not be people that treat each other terribly because of their skin color or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what Max is offering him, because Max comes in and sees that he's kind of basically given up.
Mm-hmm.
He keeps trying to get him. He's like, yes, tell me why you did this. And it's like, it doesn't mm-hmm. matter. They're going to kill me anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care what reason you give them as to why I did this. I'm a dead man. But Max is trying to be like, but you can fight this. You can help us fight this. Like, we can stop this from happening. And right. so Max is trying to give him this, you know, here and now we can fix this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not fix it, but we can start making it better.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I would agree, because there within the text he's saying like Max is like the Word become flesh, and there's this switch to where within the pre-trial stuff, within the trial, you're starting to get this idea that Richard Wright's trying to get across of, even if the things that this person did were reprehensible, there's a condition under which necessitated these actions, that, and there's a root cause to them that is deeper than this is just a black ape that, you know, that naturally does all these things, and we need to lynch him in order to purge, right, you know, society.
Right.
Like what Melissa was saying about earlier about the manifesto being written is that Max
has a lot of speeches.
Monopolizes his closing statement by going on this like pages and pages rant. And it's, I think it's what the title Native Son comes from of, you know, in the American experiment, there were settlers who imagined that, that, you know, like they had their own personal trials that they had to get through. And it's natural in some way that they figured, okay, if I can exploit the black man in order to create this country, then I'm going to do that for my personal gain. But then as we get further away from slavery, he's trying to say, Max in the speech he gives is trying to say, you can't act like now whenever a black man is violent or steals from you, that there's not that same natural inclination towards those acts. And yes, this person should go to jail for a long time, but in terms of killing him and acting like that's going to solve things, it's not, that's cruel and unusual.
Yeah.
And all of the, and he talks about the mob outside, and he's saying like acting like that's not just as barbaric as what Bigger did. You can't really make that argument. And that's, I think in not to close completely, but in terms of my opinion of this book, I appreciated that they weren't trying to redeem what Bigger did as a way of making some kind of grander point. What it's saying, what Bigger did was wrong.
Right.
But the
way that everyone was reacting, yeah, was wrong also.
Right. What a criminal does, regardless of their intentions, is objectively wrong. But at the same time, the punishment should fit the crime.
Yes.
And what Max is trying to...
And it's not even necessarily the punishment fitting the crime. It is, there is a system of justice in place. And you reacting to this as, like you were saying, purging something animalistic,
yeah,
from the
alien
human race,
from our society,
is not how the justice system works. This guy is a criminal. He committed a crime. He goes to trial for it. We have our little arguments. Then he gets punished. You know, like, you don't feed him to the mob outside,
right? And
that isn't correct either.
And I appreciate that, like, what it makes, like, he puts the Mr. Dalton on the witness stand, and he tries to make the point that, like, you, though you're not a bad person, you told yourself, I can throw money at this. I can have this slum where the blacks,
oh, yeah,
in our town can live.
Because he actually owned the building Bigger lived in.
Yeah. And I can give some black men jobs, and they can go to school. And that in some way is recompense for an injustice. But what Max tries to argue is that there's a difference between thinking that your actions are going to solve some temporary injustice versus this problem of oppression. This is the blacks in this country are people that were singled out for being black, and say, you're less than, you're going to be our slaves. And to think that one generation from that,
yeah,
when just
this was happening,
just putting black people in a ghetto,
right,
and giving them enough money to afford that ghetto, and think that that's justice.
Yeah,
it's not the correct.
I think it all boils down
argument.
To we recently read the transcript of a sermon about interracial marriage,
mm,
and the issue with any of these things is, you know, you think you're solving it because, oh, well, we're treating them better, or, oh, we're, you know, trying to raise their economic status, or whatever it is that the oppressor is trying to do for the people that are oppressed. It's like, oh, but we're treating them so well. Yes, but you are keeping them over there, and you are still afraid of them, and you are treating them as not you.
Right.
Right. There is still this division between, oh, no, that's them and this is us, and we are not mixing that. And that's wrong. They're human beings. They are citizens of this country. They are everything that you are. And treating them as if they are not is wrong. We need to get over the whole, oh, but we're treating them nice thing. It's nothing to do about treating them nice. It's treating them equal. And there is a difference.
Right. I think on a positive note, I really appreciated this about, I was listening to a podcast recently with Kevin Hart. And he was saying part of what he wants his own brand to be about is about reaching out to the Black community. But one way that he wants to do that is that he sat down with, like, I don't know if it's Merrill Lynch, but like different bank executives. And he was saying, like, when you do a program to try to do, like financial wellness type stuff, and they see just this white guy, they're going to be like, well, he doesn't know what it's like to be in my situation. But that's part of what he is trying to accomplish, is to say, like, if you put somebody who's been through what it's like to be in a ghetto and what it's like to, you know, be from the projects, whatever the situation is, and they're able to reach out to the Black community and show them, you know, what are some ways to improve your situation, then it's much more natural, and it doesn't come across as patronizing. So I feel like it made me feel better after reading this book that, like, there are people within the Black community that are trying to do that for their community. And, but to your point, and what I've often talked about in terms of trying to learn more about the Black experience and everything, is that if they're, like, we want to be able to be ignorant in some respects in order to learn, like, there are going to be things that a person says or does just because they're ignorant. But from what you're saying, like, we want to try to create a world where we can still interact and learn from each other.
Right.
And there's a definite difference between somebody who is acting ignorant and thinks that they have the grand solution.
Right. As opposed to those of us who are like, I'm sorry if we say something stupid, I might not know better.
Yeah.
Right.
But wants to learn.
But wants to learn.
Yeah. And so that's what I feel like this book is that, like, I think you can read this and definitely have arguments with Richard Wright's point and talk about what are the negative and positive aspects of how he makes his points, how he does the story. If there are parts, like you were saying, that lag and where you're just like, okay, I get the point. Please move on.
I've read the Marx Manifesto. I don't need to read that too.
Right. Like, but I appreciate that there in some respect are these books that are relevant and that are trying to do some of that very difficult education about abuse, about race relations, about economics. Like, this is a very difficult read. But I think it's definitely...
But I think it was worth it just to see what was going on inside of his head. Mm-hmm. You know, I hadn't thought, like I was talking about at the beginning, I hadn't thought of the paranoia aspect of it, things like that.
Right.
That I just didn't expect to be going on inside of his head.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I don't know these things, but yeah. Now I know a little bit more.
But yeah, it's a good case too. And like, we did stop watching the movie 5 minutes in, but in terms of, like, why those things kind of rub me the wrong way is that there aren't many people, like, for example, one good example is Jordan Peele, that are very good at putting you in that person's shoes. And that's one thing that this book does well that I think is my biggest takeaway from literary fiction novels is writing something in such a way that you feel like you're them and you feel like you're experiencing life through this person's eyes. And so in our books today, in our films today, there aren't many exceptional voices that are able to put you in the situation without just preaching about anti-racist, anti-misogynist things. Like, they're able to actually put you in those person's shoes and say, like, this is how this person it has to live in order to get by. This is how this person has convinced themselves they need to think in order to survive. And they can be a fully fleshed out character while still pointing out things about the outside, you know, things about society. So I enjoyed, wrong word. I got a lot out of it.
Yes.
I appreciated the writing style and those things. Hopefully the next time that we have a literary fiction novel, it's somebody that has this type of writing skill.
Yes.
Because it certainly makes it
easier to do.
Tolerable to get through some of these difficult topics.
Yes.
But yeah, and thanks for watching the first Read the Fifth. Our next thing is going to be, which I should have gotten on the fifth, but I'm slacking.
He's behind.
but because the Avengers Infinity
Woo-hoo!
War part
Endgame
part two part anyway
part 12. I forget how many movies there are now.
Yeah,
oh, Lord.
Part 24.
It's a lot. They're actually doing a marathon somewhere. I have to look that up. They're doing all of them. I don't know who's going to sit there for that one.
Gonna die.
I know, right?
Too much popcorn. We're going to try to read Infinity Gauntlet and talk about that on the 29th, I think, is when that episode will be released, to talk about how they differ, but also more of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, what those characters mean to us, what maybe some speculation about where the whole series is going to go. So that's Infinity Gauntlet is going to be our book for the next, for the month of April.
Because we need something less heavy. Now, if we're talking about Infinity War being a less heavy thing than the book we just read, no. A lot of people were sad after that movie.
Yeah. No comment. All right. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you later.
Bye. Stop the recording.